Good morning and welcome to the Beacon. Good morning, I'm Bill Jurek. Thanks for joining us. Lainey's on vacation this week. She's out of town enjoying California. But we have a very special treat for you today. It's one of our profile programs. We'll be featuring Mr. Jim Kesteluth, the former chief executive officer at the Chicago Lighthouse and president, now a board member there and also a board member of the American Foundation for the Blind, as well as sitting on a very special Ability One committee in Washington, D.C. We'll get our interview with Mr. Kesteluth underway right after this.
Hi, I'm Erica Borgren, Iraq veteran and director of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. Our mission is to empower veterans and their families to thrive. Our agency is home to a team of veterans whose sole job is to help other veterans. But we can't do this work alone. We need Illinois veterans to stand up and be counted so we can better understand and serve our veteran community. You have already stood up to answer the call to service. Now, stand up and be counted to help the entire veteran community. Visit veterans.illinois.gov.
Coming to the end of summer, and we thought it would be an appropriate time to do another one of our profile shows here on the Beacon. And let's see, in the past, we've talked to Steve and Georgiana Pangier. We talked about retired Cook County Circuit Court Judge Nick Pomeroy and about his career. And we are going a little bit closer to home now, being that the Beacon program is underwritten by the Chicago Lighthouse and Friedman Place. And when I say closer to home, I'm talking about the Chicago Lighthouse, because a gentleman who was a fixture for the Lighthouse in many years, someone who was recognized as being a leader, a innovator at the Lighthouse, was a gentleman by the name of Jim Kesteluth. And we want to welcome to the program this morning. Jim is the former executive director of the Lighthouse, currently is a member of the U.S. Ability One Commission, and sits on the Lighthouse board as well as the board for the American Foundation for the Blind. Jim, welcome. It's nice to have you on the program.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
You know, you and I have talked off the air a lot about the similarities that we have in common, the fact that we both came from the same Northwest Side neighborhood in Chicago. And when we compared notes, we found out we had a lot in common. And it was Jim's efforts that actually saved Chris Radio, which is the Chicago Radio and Information Service, one that I've talked about on this Beacon program for quite a few months, quite a few years now, as a matter of fact, when I think about it, because the show's 5 years old. And we talk about it and how we like to invite people to come in and be volunteer readers for us. We had a chance of going under, and it was through Jim's foresight that we were able to become one of the 28 programs that are offered by the Chicago Lighthouse, and we're very grateful for that fact. But you've got a story all unto yourself, because you've done a lot of different things, and you did them at a time when, well, people were not expecting a lot of someone who had a disability, whether it was a outward disability, an inward disability. In your case, it was vision, just like it was mine. How did this all get started? When did you first discover, your family discover, that you had a vision problem?
Well, that's an interesting question. I remember as a small child being at Humboldt Park, and I'm talking about a small child. I maybe was 3 years old or so, and we were in the boathouse at Humboldt Park. I was with my brothers, and we were fishing for bullheads, and my brothers were looking over the edge of the pier in the boathouse and saying, you know, here, look at there's some bullheads here, drop your line here. And I could hear the echoing, you know, of them saying where the fish were. But when I looked over the edge of the pier, I couldn't see anything.
Uh-huh.
And even at age three, I realized I couldn't see. But I wasn't able at that age really to articulate it very well, if at all, to my parents. And it was probably a year or two after that. I was probably in kindergarten, and we went to a picnic on a farm, And someone was sitting in a chair, and somebody said, go give your uncle a hug. It really wasn't my uncle. I don't know who it was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a 4 or 5 year old ran up to him, and I caught, he had a cigar in his mouth, only I didn't see the cigar, and I caught that cigar in my eye.
Ooh.
But there wasn't any damage, you know, from the cigar. Parents immediately took me to the emergency room and an ophthalmologist, and the ophthalmologist said the reason they told he told my parents the reason I ran into that cigar was because I didn't see it.
Right.
The cigar burn really didn't do any permanent damage, but through that examination, it was discovered that I had cone rod dystrophy and was legally blind.
What is that? So people understand what that's about, cone and rod dystrophy.
Well, the you know, sometimes you hear this term macular degeneration,
right.
Age-related macular degeneration. There is a juvenile form of macular degeneration, and you can break that down into several different types, and one type is cone rod dystrophy. The macula is the central part of your retina where images are focused. Usually has to do with seeing small things and seeing detail and color, that type of thing. You can see gross objects, larger objects, but generally with that kind of eye condition, the bigger the object is, the easier it is to see, and the closer the object is, the easier it is to see, the heavier the contrast, the easier it is to see. But with detail, with juvenile macular degeneration or age-related macular degeneration, something that happens older to older people, age-related macular degeneration, usually the ability to read print fails because print is so small.
Right.
In the early days, when I was 4 or 5, you know, I could move around, see tables and chairs and couches, but I couldn't see the small things, so it was difficult and is generally difficult for parents of small children to really pick it up until the child goes into kindergarten or first grade when they start having to, you know, use their vision on detailed type things such
sure.
as reading.
Right. So did you have, obviously you must have had when you did start school, some difficulty reading the regular texts that were in the primer books for reading and that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, in those days there was no technology.
No, absolutely.
So, you know, when I look back at my first 8 years, you know, my grammar school years, I never had a book I could read.
That was pretty tough because you had gone not to Chicago public schools, but you went to private school, right?
Right, you know, various Catholic parochial schools, mm-hmm. but they made sure I got through. Great respect, you know, for the parochial school system mm-hmm. because at the time, such minimal resources, yet I was able to get through that. When I started high school, my brothers went to Lane Tech, so I wanted to go to Lane.
Right.
You know, but when I got there, I mean, it was a massive school, 5,000
right.
students at the time. Numbers were above the doors. Couldn't read the numbers. Couldn't find a classroom.
Sure.
Had a locker. Numbers were too high to read. Couldn't
right.
find my locker. Couldn't read the blackboard. There were no large print books or anything like that at the time. So it took about a month for them to figure out, you know, I needed a special program, and I was referred to Schurz High School.
They did have a special program over there, right, at Schurz?
At Schurz, they had a program for students who were blind and visually impaired. And, you know, that was 1958.
Mm-hmm.
So the Illinois Instructional Materials Center wasn't in existence at that time. That didn't come into existence in 1965, and that's a program that supplies
mm-hmm.
students in grade school and high school with large print books or braille books. So I went in 1958 to Schurz High School, and even then did not have any books I could read.
How did the instruction go then, since there wasn't that material there?
You know, I'd take my books, throw it in the locker, close the locker, and then I would depend on listening in the classroom.
Right.
But it wasn't long. I was probably at, you know, in September I was at Lane. By the 1st of October, I was at Schurz.
Right.
But then I got a call from a former teacher. My parents got a call from a former teacher at St. Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
The nun said, you know, you got to take Jim over to see this doctor, Dr. Lieberman and Dr. Kraft.
Mm-hmm. All right. Right.
And
that's something we both have in common, too, by the way, both of those ophthalmologists. Yeah, go ahead.
Dr. Lieberman was one of 5 ophthalmologists that the Chicago Chicago Ophthalmological Society appointed to help set up a low vision clinic,
mm-hmm.
The first in America. So he was involved in setting up a low vision clinic. So
did he work with Dr. Rosenblum on that?
Right.
Okay.
There were five ophthalmologists and five optometrists that were appointed. Five optometrists from Illinois Optometric Association, and Dr. Rosenblum was one that was appointed to help set up the clinic, along with four other optometrists and five ophthalmologists.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember my parents, they were going to go see, we're going to go to the lighthouse. We saw Dr. Lieberman and Kraft, and they said, you know, take Jim over to the lighthouse. They have a low vision clinic there. But I remember thinking, another doctor.
Yeah.
Parents take their kids everywhere, you know, to try to resolve that kind of problem.
Absolutely.
So when I was coming to the lighthouse, I thought to myself, yeah, right, another doctor. But I humored my parents
and
went. But I'll never forget sitting in the exam chair and a doctor, Dr. Rosenblum, putting a trial frame on my face with a low vision lens in it, a microscopic lens. Took a card, put it in my hand with various size print on it, took my hand and he pushed it up to the lens, about an inch away from the lens,
right.
A microscopic lens. And I was so stunned because I could see print.
Right.
I just
first time ever, right?
First time ever, and stood up out of the exam chair, you know.
Yeah.
And that was so. I was a freshman in high school.
Right, about 14.
And I could see the print, and I with that lens, that was probably the most important thing that ever happened to me was getting a low vision exam, because I was able to read my way through high school slowly, very slowly, but comfortably, and you know through. Through college, too.
Yeah. So you finished the 4 years at Schurz, and then you had to make a decision at that point what you wanted to do. What was one of your ambitions, and were you always set on getting involved in working with the visually impaired? I'll tell you what, hang on a second. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about, we'll get the story of how you, started down the path of your adulthood. We're talking to Jim Kestelud, who is the former executive director over at the Chicago Lighthouse and now sits on the U.S., make sure I get it right.
Ability One
Commission, and is also on the board of directors for the American Foundation of the Blind. We'll be back with more of Jim's story on our profile program right after this.
So, you know, I'm a dog, and I'm kind of new to this family, but I've noticed a trend. My humans do this thing where they go around and get all my toys and hide them in this basket, but it's always the same basket, and it's always the same place, and then they act so surprised when I find them, but I'm like, hello? That's where you put it last time. Humans are the worst at hide-and-go-seek.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Thanks for joining us on this Saturday morning. We're glad that you could join us for breakfast and also to be part of one of our profile programs that we do here on the Beacon from time to time. Jim Kestelud is joining us, and a lot of people in the blind, the visually impaired community know that name just by mentioning it. They know who you are and what your background is. And Jim was the former executive director here at the Lighthouse and also has quite a few other important credentials. We've gotten to a point now in Jim's career and his life where he had graduated high school and you were about to set out on your path for adulthood. Did you have any idea what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't. But you know what? I was fortunate to have at Schurz a vision teacher there named Eugene Fahey. He was in charge of the program for students with visual impairments.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't know what I wanted to do, I think he saw as his job to make sure that I started thinking about that his students started to think about that and started some planning in that regard. And he referred me over to Illinois Department of Rehabilitation Services.
Mm-hmm.
And they got me thinking more about going on to college and applied to Loyola and was accepted.
Jim, what was the whole attitude? It was a lot different back at the time you were starting to go into college than it is today about students with visual impairment and that. Did people still have that stereotype about what you could and what you couldn't do, or what you should be able to do and what you shouldn't be able to do?
Oh, sure. You know, and in those days, there weren't any special services that existed with universities or colleges. So, you know, it was almost a hit-and-miss kind of thing. Loyola, I think, was way, way ahead of its time. Mm-hmm. There were a number of totally blind students going to Loyola, both in undergraduate and graduate programs in law school. Students were accepted there. So I think they were kind of a natural, but that was something I didn't know at the time.
Right.
So, you know, I got a call from them after I took the entrance exam. And somebody there was very perceptive because I didn't tell anybody that I had a visual impairment. But,
right.
you know, when I read, you know, my face is right on that paper,
that
low vision lens. So somebody noticed it, and I got a phone call after the exam. And I was told, you know, my scores were good enough for liberal arts. And
sure.
asked me if I wanted to go to Loyola, and of course I said yes. And then State Department of Rehabilitation Services helped pick up some of the costs mm-hmm. of the tuition and books.
So you had taken a liberal arts course.
I had a,
Little did you know where it was going to take you after the fact, right?
Yeah, I got a bachelor's degree in social sciences.
So
just a general degree.
So you got out, now you walked out of the graduation ceremony at Loyola, and you're holding your degree in your hand, and it's a social sciences. And did you kind of look and say, okay, what do I do now?
Yeah, absolutely. Started looking for a job.
Yeah.
And one of the first places I went to was Loyola University's placement service.
Sure.
And started getting calls from them for interviews, you know. And then I set up this little office in my basement and made lots of calls and sent out lots of letters myself.
Sure.
And I graduated in January of 67, but I finished everything in the summer of 66.
Okay.
So at the end of August, I had all the credits I needed. I was really done with classroom work, so I started looking for a job. And, you know, wasn't having any luck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things that happened was towards the end of September, I get a call from Loyola's placement service.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman there named Rosemary Deegan who had cerebral palsy.
Okay.
And she ran the placement service. I don't know how she knew I had a visual impairment, but she knew.
Right.
She called and says, "You got a job yet?" And, and I says, "Well, no."
Yeah.
And she says, "Well, there's this job open with Cook County Employment Service, Cook County Welfare Rehabilitation Service, also known as Cook County Employment Service,"
right.
which later was merged into State Department of Labor,
right.
the State Employment Service. And I said, "Well, I don't have a job." And she says, "Well, there's a job opening over there for a counselor, placement counselor." And I remember it was a Friday, and I said, "Okay, I'll go over there Monday morning." She says, "No, you won't. You're going to go there right now."
Yeah.
So I got there at like 4 o'clock and worried about, do I tell this person I'm visually impaired who's interviewing
sure.
me and things. But I got a clue when the person interviewing me said that he got his job through Rosemary Deegan.
Uh-huh.
So I got hired, and I went to work for Welfare Rehab Service, which had Cook County Employment Service. So
sure.
I started, and they had all kinds of training programs for people who had special problems,
right.
including people with disabilities and people being released from
prison and that sort of thing.
Back wards of hospitals,
sure.
mental hospitals. So there was kind of a trend at that time to deinstitutionalize people, and they were referred into our program. We would do training, and I would look for jobs for them.
Right.
And one day this guy walks in and asks the director of the agency if he could have access to the county's job bank. He wanted to know the job openings. And the director of the agency brought him over to me, and he was the placement counselor from the Chicago Lighthouse.
Okay.
And he wanted to be able to call the State Employment Service and find out what job openings there were that he could refer people who are blind.
Blind vision.
He wanted a resource.
Yeah.
So the director connected him with me, so we got to be pretty good friends. I would, refer him job openings that came, mm-hmm. or if he called with somebody, I'd check, see what job openings there were, take the case, refer. And then he retired. When he retired, I applied for his job at the Chicago Lighthouse and was hired.
Lo and behold.
That was 1969. January of 1969.
So that's how it all began, when you started here at the Chicago Lighthouse.
Yes.
So you were actually in placement?
For 8 years.
For 8 years. Oh, my goodness. You've seen a lot of people come through. You've seen people who were clients. You've seen people who were proteges and professionals with you. In that department, you had a lot of exposure to a lot of different people. Did you see a commonality of people as far as their attitude when it came to working? Because I know one of your favorite lines, and I've quoted you many times on it, is that the one thing that a blind person wants more than anything else is a job. And we know that the unemployment rate for people who are blind, visually impaired, is well over 70%. Eagerness was always there, wasn't there? Or did you see some people who were extremely eager and some who were just there?
No, I think I like how you put it. I think if you ask any blind person what they want, they'll tell you they want a job. And, you know, as I talk about some of my own experiences, they're not unique. I consider everything I've said here to be common.
Sure.
A common experience. Experiences that most people who are blind have. But worrying about getting a job is one of them. And, mm-hmm. you know, the desire to work and to be independent and to do a job to an employer's satisfaction, to mm-hmm. sort of like an industrial and commercial standard, is really what people want. And that's one of the things I think I've always seen with people coming in into the Lighthouse. A lot of times, of course, you know, people are dealing with very traumatic life experience of mm-hmm. losing vision. So you have to maybe deal with some denial at first and some depression and
anger and that sort of thing.
But by and large, somebody walked through the door, they were coming, walked through the Lighthouse door. One of their goals, I think, in a common goal of everybody was really to take a look at an employment plan, a job plan.
Sure.
What do I need to do to get a job and mm-hmm. hold a job and be independent?
Was it easy to find positions at that time?
You know, that was when I started here in January of 69. That was before the Rehabilitation Act of 73.
And right.
Rehab Act of 73 made it illegal to discriminate if you had a federal contract of $2,500 or more. It made it illegal to discriminate against a person with a disability. So when I started here in 69 and when I started with the employment service in 66, mm-hmm. you know, it was legal to give a physical and to say to somebody, I'm not going to hire you because you're
visually impaired. Yeah,
you
know? Right.
So it was more difficult because it was legitimate to deny somebody a job because of a disability. It's funny, a lot of times I hear people say, well, I don't know if the Americans with Disabilities Act has done much good. There's still lots of unemployment. But mm-hmm. if they don't have anything to compare it to, I've been around a long time, so I can compare it to when it was legal to discriminate.
Right.
And it was a huge change in 73 when that Rehab Act came into existence because it required employers to have some kind of affirmative action plan, and mm-hmm. it was legitimate to talk to people and to consider someone with a disability for a job. So that made a huge difference. Prior to that, you know, I learned how to contact employers from working for the county employment service.
Right.
You know, calling, explaining your program, going to visit them, making referrals of qualified people.
Sure.
You know, so I learned how to do it. And, you know, most employers want to do the right thing. I think prior to 73, they weren't sure what the right thing was.
Right. That's true, yeah.
After 73, still was hard to get people jobs because you had the psychological barriers that employers
right.
have. A lot of people think if you're blind, you may as well be dead. How can you hold a job?
Yeah, I know,
My philosophy at the time was face-to-face. I would want a face-to-face meeting with the employer. I'd walk in, And probably halfway through my interview with the employer, I would mention that I was legally blind. And
right.
They could see that...
You were able to function.
And that blindness was on a continuum of, you know, being legally blind, having some low vision to total blindness.
Sure.
So...
You said 8 years in placement and in job working with people to find employment for people who came to the Lighthouse. What happened after the 8 years?
I mean, one of the things I did when I started working at the Lighthouse, I wanted to do everything.
Right.
So not just placement. So whenever there was the Lighthouse was shorthanded somewhere, mm-hmm. you know, I would try to step in, like in the recreation program. If you know, we had a program going, I'd step in if they needed an extra hand. Or when I would go out and talk with employers, because one of the things the Lighthouse has is a manufacturing program.
Right. Was that in existence at the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
When I started, that was probably the 90% of what the Lighthouse did. We had an industries program mm-hmm. that employed about 200 people who were blind and manufacturing products.
Right.
And so if I was out talking to an employer, I would throw that in, too. Do you have any contracts?
Sure.
That we could bid on, so we would. I would bring in contracts for the shop as well as making placements outside. So I always wanted to sort of
do it all, know
everything,
it all. Yeah.
Because you know, as openings occur above,
right,
they'll look for someone who knows something about that.
Absolutely,
maybe has some experience there. So I always enjoyed. Trying to learn everything.
You know, and that's so true not only for people with a disability, but it's also true for anybody in the general public. If you want to move up, the more you know about the company you're working with or the profession that you're in, the better your chances are of making that move up and that. And then, I mean, it just holds through. So you, after the employment services, what was the next, your next hurdle?
Well, you know, the shop was, we had some major contracts, one of which was with Western Electric, which basically went out of business.
Yeah.
They changed their name, Lucent Technologies and other things, AT&T, whatever.
Right.
But you know, one of the major products we had was automated out of existence. So the shop experienced a shortage of work.
Right.
So I was looking for contracts, and eventually they just, you know, I was bringing in some contracts to compensate for the loss of a product that mm-hmm. was automated out of existence, and I was offered the job of running the shop.
Okay,
So I took it.
They figured, what the hell? This guy goes out and gets the work. We might as well put him in charge of the shop. Yeah.
So then but they never took placement away from me.
Right.
You know, I ran the shop and was in charge of placement too. That sort of followed me through my whole career.
You're good at this. But, you know, we still want to keep you in placement. Yeah, that's it.
That's one thing I'd have to say about Chicago Lighthouse. They always recognize, right from the day I started, the importance of competitive job placements.
Sure.
Move a person in to our program, give them some experience, let them gain some confidence and some skills, and then what you want to do is move them into a competitive job. It always had we had a great philosophy. Still have that philosophy here.
What was the when did you how many more jobs? Because we're going to take a quick break here. We're going to get into your being selected as the executive director. But after the running the shop and doing the placement, what else did you do before?
Well,
you get...
I got the opportunity for the shop from Milt Samuelson, became executive director in the late 70s.
Okay.
And then he was second in command. But as he moved up, I moved up. So,
right.
You know, we worked well together.
Right.
You know, he would give me assignments, and I tried to pull him off as best as I could.
You could, sure.
So I ran eventually, at one time or another, every single program at the Lighthouse, either collectively or individually.
Right.
Eventually became director of professional services and then assistant executive director, then executive director and president of the
Lighthouse.
And
what year was that?
Executive director probably 95 and president a few years after that.
Now, we're going to pause here, take another quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about, you know, taking on the role of the head honcho, the chief with the big headdress at the Chicago Lighthouse. We're talking to Jim Kestelud on our profile show this morning on The Beacon. We're glad you could join us, and we'll be back with more right after this.
Hi, this is Karen Tamley, Commissioner of the Mayor's Office for People with Disabilities, calling all seniors and people with disabilities. The City of Chicago's Voluntary Emergency Assistance Registry provides police, fire, and other emergency personnel with important information about the type of assistance you would need in the event of an emergency. The information is confidential and will only be used by first responders. It only takes a few minutes to complete the online registry form at www.cityofchicago.org/voluntary registry. Or if you do not have access to a computer or want more information, please call the Mayor's Office for People with Disabilities at 312-744-7050.
Let's see. The gentleman who's sitting here and we're doing a profile this morning is got an extremely varied background, but with one commonality in mind, and that is to make sure that there's equality for people who are blind and visually impaired. He's got quite a few very impressive credentials with him, one of them which we'll be talking about a little bit later on in this segment. But now we're at 1995, and you've taken on the position of executive director at the Lighthouse. What was your reaction? How did you feel? Were you scared?
I was probably surprised that I got an opportunity to be.
Do that? Yeah.
Yeah, because if you look back at, in 1995, there were very few people who were blind running not-for-profits
right.
in America at that time. So, again, when I think about Chicago Lighthouse and its own attitude and, you know, it just wasn't afraid to, put on in the head position someone who was blind.
You were comfortable. They were comfortable with you, and you were comfortable because you knew what the departments were all about and knew what the organization was all about and where it was heading.
You know, I knew blindness.
Yeah.
And I wrote most of our state and federal grants.
Sure.
And managed those. But I'll never forget when I interviewing for executive director, I was asked, what are your weaknesses?
Yeah.
You know, I think my weakness was fundraising.
Okay.
So,
Welcome to the club. Oh, God, do I know that feeling well, you know, yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I felt the agency had to have was someone in a management level, management team level
sure.
position in fundraising. A professional.
Right.
And we moved to that, and I'll tell you, I learned a lot.
That's the important thing that you learn when to strengthen that weakness is to learn. You know, we talked about the professional career. We're going to get back to talk more about that because you held the position of executive director until 2008.
2009.
2009, and you saw a lot of changes made. But let's talk a little bit about Jim and Barb Kestelud. Because there was a time in the life when there was a very special lady in your life, and she stuck with you through all these years, right?
Yeah, we got married 46 years.
Congratulations. Congratulations. God bless that woman. She's put up with you for 46 years.
Oh, yeah.
But you've had a family. You've had everything that anyone could want and hope for. As far as a good personal life, I mean, I've talked to you off the air, and I know very much how close you are with your family and how much you value the time that you spend with them and everything. And you've had a job over the years where you've had to be away from them for a time because of the responsibilities of the job and everything. And I think you feel it's important to have somebody who's working with you as part of your team, meaning your wife Barb, that was there for you to help you out.
I'm so glad you brought that up because, I have met Barb. We were just kids, basically. She was a senior in high school. I was in my first year of college.
Yeah.
And we have three kids. One's an attorney for Ford Motor Company. One operates and, has a brewery in Iowa.
No kidding.
And the other is a vice president of a company in Des Moines.
You got to be very proud.
And I think the most important ingredient in rehabilitation is love.
Mm-hmm.
If you have someone losing sight, I mean, how can you adjust to the loss of sight if you're not loved?
Right.
So I think, I think a lot of times parents get bad raps. They're doing this wrong or that wrong.
Sure.
But in general, the most important ingredient in rehabilitation is being accepted, being loved, being understood, some motivation.
Sure.
Love is what does that, I think. So it's an important thing.
And I have to tell everybody, it still exists because we had the installation of officers for the Central Lions Club earlier this month. And Jim and Barb sat with me at the table along with our district governor, Dave Hansen. And we had just a great time. It was terrific. And you could see that the relationship has done everything and has grown over the years. Just the relaxedness between the two of you. I mean, it was just amazing. It was really good. It's an example for a lot of people to be able to see what a great relationship that you guys have had. Now, you left the Lighthouse in 2009. You retired at that point. And you took on a bigger responsibility, a bigger role, I think, when you got involved with the U.S. Ability One Commission. Tell us a little bit about that. Were you surprised when you were asked to become part of that commission?
I was surprised because the commission has 15 members appointed by the President of the United States. The commission was created in 1938 by an act of Congress. And the commission is made up of 15 members, as I said, appointed by the president. 11 members are executives in the federal government, and 4 are private citizens that the president also appoints. And the there's probably a lot of people who would like to have that position.
Sure.
So from that standpoint, I consider myself very fortunate. I was appointed by President Obama in 2010. I'm currently the vice chairman of the U.S. Ability One Commission.
Are you really? Congratulations. That's great.
The commission has the power through the act of Congress and through its members casting votes to issue production and service contracts to not-for-profits that employ people who are blind or employ people with disabilities. So we do about $3 billion in sales a year.
Wow.
And all of the production is done by not-for-profits across America, both serving people with general disabilities and people who are blind.
Do we see, Jim, because of the industry's program that the Chicago Lighthouse has, I'm sure there's other organizations, social service agencies and not-for-profits that have industry's programs as well, not only for visually impaired, but I'm talking for developmentally disabled, for hearing impaired, for other types of physical disabilities and that. Do we find that with the economy having come off of a very deep recession that it's more difficult to get the work for the organizations that are performing the services and the products?
Yeah, that's also a very good question. There are actually 596 not-for-profit agencies across America that have contracts through the U.S. Ability One Commission. And again, it's $3 billion in sales.
Sure.
And this year, of course, Congress implemented sequestration.
Right.
Which is involves austerity, cutbacks in spending, cutbacks in travel, cutbacks in all kinds of things to deal with the federal deficit. So because of that, a lot of the agencies that receive Ability One contracts have had their contracts reduced and in some cases eliminated. So it's put a burden on a lot of the not-for-profits who depend on federal contracts to employ people who are blind and employ people with disabilities. There are some agencies that have had a severe experience in cutbacks and layoffs because of federal contracts downsizing, or just the federal government's austerity in purchasing products that they have contracts for.
Mm-hmm.
It's not unusual to see an agency that might have had to lay off 30, 40, 50 people because the products and services aren't in demand because of sequestration mm-hmm. itself. So yeah. it puts a new onus on the Ability One Commission and on not-for-profits to come up with ideas for contracts and maybe even to look to the private sector for contracts to supplement their federal work. Cool. One of the contracts Chicago Lighthouse has through the U.S. Ability One Commission is the manufacture and supply of clocks to right. the federal government. So that's through the U.S. Ability One Commission. So Chicago Lighthouse supplies all federal agencies, both civilian and military, with clocks, employs maybe 15, 20 people here at
right.
the Lighthouse.
Right.
So most agencies that supply products or supply services have had cutbacks because of
sequestration. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. It sounds like a lot of agencies need the young Jim Kestelud, who not only went out looking for people, for jobs for people, but to bring back contracts to work in their particular shops and services areas and that. You're on the committee. How long does your term last for the commission?
I was appointed July of 2010 through December of 2014.
Okay.
But I'd be eligible for a reappointment.
At that point?
Yes.
Do you,
it's a five-year appointment.
What do you look for as your future once you get done? Let's say you do get appointed for another term. Are you going to retire or are you going to keep going?
You know, it's pretty hard to leave the Lighthouse. You know, I was, you know, working here since January of 69.
Right.
But my first contact with the Lighthouse was when I was 13.
Yes.
1958.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm into, 55, 60 years
right.
Contact with the Lighthouse. So, you know, the place gets in your blood.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And I have great respect for Janet Slick, who's the current president mm-hmm. of the Chicago Lighthouse. Very innovative thinking,
mm-hmm.
Very into creating jobs for people who are blind. You know, I'd like to hang around and still do what I can.
Sure.
On the board here at the Chicago Lighthouse.
Through Dr. Slick, I mean, we see the how things have adapted to the 21st century with the call centers now, getting contracts to do more of that type of work for right. employment opportunities for people with disabilities, not only visually impaired, but people with disabilities in general. So
one of the U.S. Ability One Commission contracts that was issued to the Chicago Lighthouse was a U.S. Army contract closing out
mm-hmm.
U.S. Army contracts. So we probably, Chicago Lighthouse probably has 10 to 15 people who are blind working at the Rock Island Arsenal,
mm-hmm.
one of our sites right there on the military base, and here at the Chicago Lighthouse where we employ people who are blind as contract closeout officers. They're on Lighthouse payroll,
sure.
But they close out contracts just like contract officers do for the federal government in the same pay. Roughly the same, well, not roughly, it is the same
yeah.
pay as if you were a contract officer, closeout officer for a federal government. So so some very innovative contracts that Janet's brought in.
So we're not looking for Jim Kestelud to retire anytime soon, to stay active, to stay involved, and to keep bringing along the yeah. knowledge that you've gained over the years, like you said, in many different areas, and
yeah.
you're doing that now with the outside, with the U.S. Ability One Commission, with your membership on the board over at the American Foundation of the Blind. We didn't even touch on that, but we're running a little bit out of time.
Well, the American Foundation for the Blind, that's really Helen Keller's organization. Helen Keller worked for American Foundation for the Blind for over 40 years.
Sure.
And she left her archives to the American Foundation for the Blind. I see them as an agency that helps really set national policy
mm-hmm.
for issues related to blindness.
Well, that's good. I'm glad. And they couldn't ask for a better guy. Because if you don't know the answer, you'll know where to go get it. That's for doggone sure. Hey, thanks for taking time joining us early on this Saturday morning to talk a little bit about you. And as we were talking about before we got on the air, you enjoy talking about the experiences because you've had a lifetime like I did, where you it may have worked, but it didn't feel like it because you've enjoyed what you did. You've had the ability to do all your life.
Well, thanks for having me, Bill.
Thanks for being part of the Lighthouse, and thanks for joining us on our program this morning. Our show is The Beacon, Tom's Corner.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome in. It's another Tom's Corner. Good morning, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing fine, as always. And it's a lovely Saturday morning and lots to talk about in the area of wearable tech. Wearable
right.
tech.
Wearable. Something you wear.
Yes.
And that seems to be a kind of a new trend in technology. And, of course, we're considered one of the leaders here in different types of products and strategies to help blind and visually impaired people who might need special technology. So you might remember last year we were one of the first, after the FDA approval of the BrainPort device, which is like a little pair of sunglasses that would mm-hmm. work with a camera for somebody who's totally blind. And how that works is it displays an array of pixels that are actually sitting on your tongue. So imagine if you're walking through a room and the windows, you'd be able to see the outline of the windows, and it actually appears on your tongue. Or there might be a post in the room,
right.
Or there might be where the door meets the door frame. Anything that would stand out, especially dark and light colors, would actually show up as an image. And that your tongue is 20 times more sensitive than your index finger. So that's why the company called WICAB, WICAB, out of Madison, Wisconsin, developed that product. So it doesn't replace the white cane, but it's a way to augment in giving blind people more information than normally would get. So we had a brand new company come this last week, and it's actually started by a PhD student here at University of Illinois, and he has developed a wearable jacket for blind people.
And how does that work?
And it didn't fit me because I wear double extra large. But we had Luke and Misa and others tried it. And so what it does, it has sensors built in the jacket mm-hmm. and in the arms. And basically, so let's say a blind person or somebody with very low vision were walking along and somebody came up from behind, the jacket would start to pulsate. And the closer that person got, the more intense the pulsation sensation would be mm-hmm. on your back
right.
or on your right arm or on your left arm, depending on where the obstacles are coming from and so forth. And so it was very, very unique, I thought. The company is called Spider Sense. So it's spider-sense, SENSE.com,
right.
if you want to go look at it. And it has some interesting video of people walking towards a wall, and they can sense the wall, so then they turn, and they develop like a maze that you can actually go through and try it. So this is not on the market yet,
mm-hmm.
but that's what I mean. We've had lots of companies come to us and help us with feedback and testing of these type of products. So again, something like that would probably not replace something like using a white cane for someone,
right.
but it would give a person a lot more information. I was thinking of myself one time when I was walking downtown, and my right eye is actually much worse than my left eye. So somebody was walking on the sidewalk towards me, right in my lane, so to speak. They weren't on their side.
Right.
And because my right eye didn't catch that person and they were kind of short, I almost like ran them down. And it scared me. I'd stopped like just a foot or two in front,
right.
thinking that, oh my God, you know, they must think I'm, you know, either overly aggressive or totally daydreaming or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how about a sensor that could go out, that you could wear, that would go out in front of you a longer distance so that it would let you know that there's an obstacle coming. Being tall, we also were trying to ask for one that would give us a tree limbs and high branches
yeah,
where we
hit our
foreheads. So this wearable technology, I think, is going to be a very important thing. Now, the last two shows, I know we talked about the ORCAM,
right,
which is wears just a tiny little thing that wears right on the edge of your glasses that will take a picture and read out loud. So that's been that's a new product from Israel that we are doing evaluations for here. So that product is already out. If you haven't seen or heard of it, you can go to ORCAM, ORCAM.com, and watch the video. We can watch our videos on our YouTube channel. And Luke did a really nice video about the ORCAM, all the different things that it can do. And our videos are YouTube.com, and search for CHI Lighthouse. All one word, CHI Lighthouse, and you'll see all of our videos there on all of this new technology that's out to help people with low vision or blindness. And, you know, I was diagnosed when I was 19 years old and went through a difficult stage of my 20s, and I really couldn't ever imagine that there'd be so many things now and so many things that are mobile that are out there to help people. Back in the day, I had a big clunky video magnifier.
Right.
It was like a small furnace, and I needed a heavy table with super heavy legs just to hold it up. So we've come a long, long way, and it's really kind of an exciting time.
Right.
Yeah.
With wearable technology.
Yeah, we've had some couple shows, and it's amazing to me. We've had people come. We've had the first show, we had over 90 people came. The last show, we had about 65 people. And many of them had never seen any of this new technology at all. And we helped turn some lives around. So come and sit with us and talk to us and learn. These shows are free. They're open to the public. And or, you know, get in touch with us here at the Chicago Lighthouse. And by the way, we're going to do the next shows. We're going to do a couple of series on the CSUN conference and what we're going to talk about, what's new worldwide, where some of these international companies are going to be unveiling some new products. So stay tuned to our show the next couple weeks for that.
All right.
Yeah.
And what about the upcoming road shows?
So the road shows, I wanted to give you the dates. March 31st from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock is at 1616 North Arlington Heights Road in Arlington Heights. That's the offices of the Wheeling Township. So we hope to see you on March 31st. Then on April 5th, we're going to be at Friendship Village in Schaumburg. That's 350 West Schaumburg Road, and that's also from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And that's a popular location. It's a great location to sit and talk and learn about all these different devices. Then South Suburbs would be April 14th at Palos Hills Community Center in Palos Hills.
That's Luke's favorite spot.
Yeah, right, exactly. Because they have the best Pepo's subs in the neighborhood, so he loves to go to that one. April 20th, we're going to be south also at the Frankfort Township office, which is 11000 West Lincoln Highway in Frankfort. What a beautiful location that is.
Mm-hmm.
They have floor-to-ceiling windows looking out over the forest, and nice and peaceful. We will be there again from 10 to 3 o'clock on April 20th. So mark your calendars, and we look forward to meeting you and talking to you, sponsored by the Lions Clubs of Illinois. HumanWare has been a big sponsor for us. The last time we had five Lions came and volunteered their time, and these were five very enthusiastic ladies who also went around and helped us sell things. I didn't realize they were going to jump right in and sell things, but they were describing our independent living aids and
right.
all kinds of things to people, so. It was fun.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
So wearable technology. I thought you would be talking just about eyewear or things that you could put on your glasses like the ORCAM, but no,
oh, right.
A vest.
Yeah, a vest. Yeah, now his idea might be to put something under your shirt,
mm-hmm.
you know, and have sensors. So obviously you're not going to wear a jacket when it's summertime or whatever.
Right.
So there might be an under-the-clothing vest or something to give you sensations. And that's the main point of what he's working on right now.
That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
All right, folks. He's Tom Percy. I'm Brian Hawkins. This is The Beacon.
Patty, I boldly went to socialsecurity.gov, and it's out of this world.
Socialsecurity.gov is a website for everybody.
Even teenagers?
Absolutely. Young people can help their grandparents with retiring online or getting extra help with their Medicare prescription drug costs.
Everyone should go to socialsecurity.gov.
That's going to do it for our Beacon program this week. We hope you've enjoyed our profile look at Mr. Jim Kestelute, who is the former president, chief executive officer at the Chicago Lighthouse. We will be back next Saturday, and Lainey will be with us. In the meantime, have yourself a great week. Thanks to Dr. Janet Slick, our executive director at the Chicago Lighthouse, for making all of this possible. Music in the background is by Mr. Mike Henson. He wrote, produced, and performed it, available at cdbaby.com. And, of course, Brian Hawkins not only did a great job in Tom's Corner, but all the fantastic work engineering our program and making it sound as good as he does every week. Stick around. The Mighty House people are coming up next. We've got a couple of words for you, then the news, and we'll see you back here next Saturday morning at 7 o'clock, right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk.